I'm Rebecca Lavoie. Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about episode 15, Going to Where the Deer Are, of season 5 of Undisclosed. It's about Jeff Titus, who was convicted of the 1990 murders of Doug Estes and Jim Bennett 12 years after the double homicide. Titus is currently incarcerated in Michigan and has always maintained his innocence. If you haven't listened to the episodes we're going to be talking about, pause this podcast, go back and listen, and then come back to this conversation because we will still be here. We have some really special guests joining us today. First, Jacinda Davis. She's an executive producer at Red Marble Media. That is the outfit behind Killer in Question, which covered the Jeff Titus case on Investigation Discovery. Hey again, Jacinda.
Hi, Rebecca.
And also with us is Kevin Fitzpatrick, the founder and EP at Red Marble Media. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, how are you?
I'm pretty well, and it's nice to talk to you again. And finally, of course, Susan Simpson, one of the hosts of Undisclosed, also a lawyer and super investigator. Hey, Susan.
Hi, Rebecca.
So I want to start here with one of my favorite topics, which is FBI profiling.
Because you love them so much.
I do. I really believe in them as crime-solving tools. Actually, anybody who follows me on podcast or Twitter knows that that's not true. They probably serve some purpose, but maybe solving crimes is not that purpose. So talk about the FBI profile here in this case and why it's important, Susan. Just remind the listeners of the context of that.
Yeah, so I think in this case, it actually matters more than I realized at first because although there was one detective on the cold case team who was always gung-ho for Titus, and that's Detective Mike Brown, that isn't true for all of them. There seems to have been a lot of sort of conflict and mind-changing and uncertainty about whether Titus was a viable suspect until the cold case team went to Quantico and talked to the FBI. After that, it was all Titus, no looking back. Is that your sense, Jacinda, of how things played out?
Yeah, I think you're right that not everyone on the cold case team was 100% on board with Titus. And what I found was something that was really interesting is that when they went to the FBI, they took one of the detectives who was actually no longer part of the task force with them. And he had always been on the side that it wasn't Titus.
Which is why he was removed from the task force.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not exactly sure why they brought him with them, like hoping, I don't know if they thought maybe he would like, you know, stand his ground and be like, no, it's not Titus. Or if they thought if they could convince him, then it must be Titus. Like, I don't know. Susan, do you have an idea why they would have brought him?
I mean, to the extent that his impression, or at least he says they was told that if they could convince Madison, then Workema would be convinced. And Madison was the doubter.
And they didn't convince him. At the end of the meeting, he still wasn't convinced it was Titus.
He also told us, and I did not realize how true it was till later on, he told us that at this meeting, so they meet with the FBI, then they have like a private meeting or go to the pub or something, just the cold case team, and he starts criticizing them for telling false facts to the FBI, which I, at that point, we hadn't received documents that reflect what happened with the FBI stuff. And when I got them, I was like, okay, I get now why Madison was so annoyed, because what they were telling the FBI was just factually either not true or based on like assumptions and like inference linking beyond what the evidence could support.
Like what?
So the big one for him was the issue with the lights. The cold case team's theory at the start was that when Titus and Driscoll walked back the field to see what was going on back there, they say it's because they saw lights in the back behind the field. They're like, okay, that's weird. Let's go check it out. And their theory was that the lights weren't put up till after Driscoll and Titus went over there, and therefore they're lying about why they walked back in the field, meaning that Titus must have known the murder happened because he did it, so he wanted to go see how his murder was going. Or, like, he didn't realize the cops were there, so he was going back to check on the crime scene, essentially. But that's just not true. Like, the timing totally fits exactly what Titus Driscoll say. So
we know that Stan Driscoll is incapable of telling lies. And Kevin,
or emoting.
And during the interview, you know, that was one of the things he said. Like, they drove into Titus's driveway and they saw lights back in the woods.
Yeah. Kevin, is it also your experience that Driscoll, from what you know about him, is not capable of telling any lies?
Yeah, he's not capable of telling lies. And to an annoying degree, you know, he sometimes wasn't capable of telling the truth. And what I mean by that is your question had to be framed in such a way that he deemed it appropriate to answer. So he could be maddening with just relaying, you know, is it raining outside? Well, you know, it's just, it wasn't that simple. But yeah, he's not capable of telling a lie in any way. And I think that he's also someone, if he feels someone is leading him with a question, be it
a
producer or the police, he's not going to go there. I mean, he's just not on principle going to go there. You know, we're talking about the facts and the information and getting it correct. There's also this concept of when they're doing a profile, is someone giving the FBI the correct information about the person? Right. Are they presenting the person in the correct way? Because they may view them in a certain way, but I may view them in another way. I may answer the questionnaire differently, but they're only going to be going on the information based on the people who are filling it out. And so that to me has always been a problem with profiles.
Isn't that what happened here, Susan? Like, who filled out this personality characteristics thing about Jeff Titus that the FBI used? Who filled that out?
It was a group effort, but the names that show up on it are both Brown and Petrosky. I'm sure others involved too. My favorite is one of the, so like basically the FBI has a form they send out with like 90 questions that they ask the various agencies that wanted their help to fill out with their suspect, like describe your suspect here so we can assess your profile of the suspect. It's kind of like one of those old school like magazine like surveys.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. It looks like one of those things they give you at the office so that you can learn how to work better with other people in the office, where you get like assigned a type like ESTJ or whatever like that. So they decided he was an extrovert. He's either like a one or a five on most of these things.
Except for the ones they don't know about, like the ones they're kind of unsure about. They're like, it's called a three. Everything else, he's one or five.
Yeah,
he's an extrovert and a loner.
Yes,
but he's definitely not a loner. He's all self-centered. He is disorderly, rebellious, vindictive, pessimistic.
Wait, is one the highest? Or is five?
I think it's two. It's like a binary scale. So like it's introvert, extrovert. So the side it's on is the most.
Oh, I see. So he's vindictive, but he's also an extrovert.
And idealistic.
Vindictive. He has, this is really something. He's independent and idealistic and insecure and manipulative. What did they base their assessments of him on?
Their impressions of him. My favorite answer was one where they just asked her to describe what Titus is like. And whoever wrote this wrote, was assessed as unpredictable and disorganized behavior under pressure. Perceived the world as a place where creatures feast or feed on each other, hanging from a meat pole or being pincushioned down. World perceived as threatening, predatory, dog-eat-dog place where a person ends up squeezed dry or in a casket. He must remain alert, guarded. Immature feeling of vulnerability and insufficiency in coping and tendencies towards erratic reactions to real or fancied threats.
Yet he's rational, according to this personality characteristics profile.
Yeah, so this is the stuff they're working off of, yeah.
At this point, no one in the cold case team has actually had an interview with Titus, right?
Like, right. Are they getting this from? Is this based on just what people say about him?
It's basically coworkers, because like the most intensive set of interviews I've done was with his coworkers at the VA.
I kind of would love to like do that. I mean, usually you're asked to fill this out about yourself, right?
Yeah.
It would be sort of fun to fill it out for other people, but also it would be completely inaccurate.
Also, someone you want to send to prison forever, so you can like do it like kind of vindictively.
I've filled one out for Jacinda once I got it, and I'll share that on the next addendum.
Was she rebellious or conservative?
Well, I think we need to get a paywall up if people really want the answer. I'll lay them out.
You know, it's so funny. Looking at this list, though, like some of these things don't even seem like opposites to me. Like one can be both conservative and rebellious. You know, it's like the vindictive or forgiving. I mean, they're not necessarily opposites either. So to sort of put them on a scale, this is very strange form. This is very strange.
Yeah. And the questions are like, what makes subject angry? And it's like, dislikes hunters coming onto his property. Well, that's not at all biased or going to influence the FBI's assessment of this crime. They also have a whole section of like what he like Titus likes. And like most of the answers are just hunting. And I'm like, actually, that's true. Fair enough.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So the information that they gave the FBI was factually wrong. In what other ways was it factually wrong, Susan?
I mean, just a lot of like little details are tweaked to make this whole idea of like, oh, of course it's Titus. Like they repeat the whole lie about how the tags are shot in the center, and then add a detail about how, in fact, pieces of the hunting licenses were found embedded inside the victims, when one of the hunting licenses wasn't even shot at all and the other was just clipped. They say police searched the area for 2 days and could not locate the weapon, the missing shotgun. But Titus went out and found it right away. They searched for like 2 or 3 hours tops, not 2 days. And they didn't search the area where it was, according to their own report. And they also described, for instance, Titus's alibi. They're like, oh, there's a 2.5 hour block of time where Titus was not accounted for. And realistically, it was like an hour and a half and a bit tops. And they say time it takes to drive from the Shepherd property to the crime scene is approximately 30 minutes in heavy traffic. No way. No way. Like, it's going to be 40 minutes. And that's like moderate traffic. Yeah. And it is an established fact that Titus had time to go to the crime scene and return without notice. Nah, not established. It's pretty debatable.
So this is like, this is just, they are going to the FBI with the outcome they want the FBI to give back to them so that they can say the FBI said all these things. Is that what was going on here?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, that's what it looks like to me.
Kevin, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that one of the things that always makes me a little nervous when people are doing profiles or they're looking at facts is in every case, and not just in this one, you have to ask if people are answering questions or filling out this questionnaire sort of skewed because they're looking at a certain outcome that they want, whether it's intentional or not. Right. Like if you have in your head that you think someone committed a crime, are you more likely or less likely to fill out questions in a manner that will lead other people to conclude that? And so I think that the concept of getting a completely unbiased form is very difficult and challenging. And even if you want to give these folks the benefit of the doubt and say they believed it took him, you know, they believed there was a 2.5 window, they believed all of that was true. They believe that you could make it in 30 minutes. Even if they believed all of those things, if we know those facts aren't true, how does all of this still factor into being an accurate profile of the case? And I think it's a very slippery slope to put too much credence behind FBI profiles because they're only working off the material that's presented to them. They haven't spoken to the suspect. They don't know all the facts of the case. I mean, they might as well be reading a newspaper article to a certain degree. And so that's troubling. If we're going to call it an expert profile from Quantico, is that really true? It may be based on the information they're given, but all of it has to be accurate.
Right.
What's hilarious to me, though, is the FBI in this case, they get this information and they, you know, make their analysis and predict their profile of Titus. And they say, analogy, serial killer. Quiet, kept itself, blended in, didn't do bizarre things, stealthy in own way. And like, you could not get a worse description of Titus if you tried.
Yeah, he wasn't quiet. He didn't keep to himself. Wasn't he kind of a loudmouth who like would bother people at work and not stop talking to them?
And bizarre, yeah. Like, that's definitely not how I describe Titus at all.
So I still contend with this case, how I felt about it when Jacinda first started talking to me about it, that if he had been a different person, if he hadn't been so off-putting, if he hadn't been someone that people dislike, that none of us would be here sitting talking about this right now.
Right. If he'd been likable. I mean, that's what it comes down to, is being likable,
yeah.
Right?
Right. Yeah. That's right.
Huh. So, talk to me about the fact that the FBI also was given information about the location that was wrong.
Yeah, we don't know again what they said in person in the meeting. We don't have all the forms because some were not produced. But we know that the location, as it was described, was, well, one, totally incorrect. At one point, they actually give an address of the murder scene, and it's like a totally different block of the area. I don't know where that came from. And in general, when they describe the stuff, they're always like, Titus told so-and-so that he killed two hunters on his property, and they're kind of quoting co-workers. They're basically all quotes of VA co-workers who vaguely remembered stuff that was garbled and like changed over the course of 5 or 6 interviews with the cold case team. So the FBI got this whole list of people with statements allegedly saying that Titus confessed to killing two hunters on his yard, on his property. At which point, like, why do you even need the profile? Like, if this case is really how it's being described, why is the cold case team going to Quantico to get an analysis? Like, if you've really got six witnesses saying that Titus told them he killed him on his property, then I think you're good to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he said something and you had it in the last episode of the podcast, and I'm blanking a little bit on it. I think Stan was talking to us at the interview that Titus told him or someone else the wrong location of the murder scene, correct? Like, he was explaining it to Stan or someone about where he was told it took place, but that wasn't the spot that, that it took place. So yeah. Even he didn't seem to know where it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do want to talk about that wrong location in a minute, because that was super fascinating. I just want to cap off the FBI, though, with one note you made that I need to know more about. The FBI gave them advice on how to prosecute this case?
The notes in the file in the case file in Kalamazoo, there's a whole little manila folder or whatever file of their Quantico stuff, and then the meeting notes and the meeting check-in stuff. And the notes talk about how, like, their advice is don't over-try case. To convince the jury, like, make sure the jury knows there's stuff we do know and stuff we don't. It's an 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle that we have 820 pieces for. No, we don't know why Tyus would leave Driscoll. Don't worry about it. Just tell the jury it doesn't matter, because we still know that he killed him. And a lot of this advice, I mean, I guess it's possible the prosecutor would have already gone this route in their arguments, but, like, it does seem like they adopted this advice in their approach to the case.
Hmm.
Which, again, I don't know. I'd hope not, but, like, it seems, I mean, it's extremely debatable whether profiling can help solve a case. The idea of using it to help prosecute a case is just kind of gross to me.
Right. I mean, I would love to know more examples, if they exist, of profiles helping solve cases. I mean, typically the only time I think I've ever seen it really applied where they say it was solved was is the Unabomber case, but there was also a sketch of what the Unabomber looked like. And there was also, like, writing that, you know, was an analyze that, like, matched the way that he wrote. So I don't know. I mean, maybe I just don't know enough about it, but I've never heard of an example of where just a profile solved a case. If anyone knows one, feel free to send me a tweet. I'd be very interested to hear about it.
I think the problem is what you'd call a profile anyway, because technically Thomas Dillon is an example of that. In that they released a description of how the crimes were done, and his friend saw it and was like, that sounds like Tom Dillon. But at the same time, Tom had also told his friend how he would commit murders if he wanted to commit them, and he described how the murders happened. So I guess, I mean, in a way you could call it the profile, but, like, also it's more like he kind of just said he'd be doing it that way. So when it does happen that way, you put one together.
It was confirmation bias, because he already had the bias that his friend was shady. And so when he heard that, he was like, oh, this could match that. No, that makes sense. That makes sense. All right. So let's talk about this confusion over the location of the shootings and how it affected the case. Susan, remind me of what we're talking about here.
So the murders happened in the Fulton State Game Area, a public area that's bordered. It's like a big, like, square block. And on the eastern border, there's a line of private properties. Tyus is about in the middle of that. And when you ask people in this case where the murders happened, they usually, I mean, I'd say basically almost always, with one exception, are going to show you a place that's fairly close to Tyus's property line. Justin was out there for both that Workman and Morsima, right?
Yes, I was out there with both of them. And, you know, it has been a long time, and neither one of them felt 100% confident, you know, pointing out the location, but they both ended up around the same spot, which was much closer to Titus's property line than was Susan and I later discovered was the actual crime scene location.
Hmm. So, Susan, talk about your sleuthing on this location. You talk about Google Maps. We hear you tromping around in some grass.
Yeah.
Like, oh, my God. What did you do to determine?
Kevin was with us. Susan took us out there for.
I know. This is where, by the way, Susan's brand of insanity comes in so handy. I hope you don't mind me saying that, Susan.
True.
But your willingness to, like, do whatever it takes, including, like, Google Earthing things and then tromping around and then, you know, looking up tree species or whatever. Kevin, you saw that in person, right?
Oh, it was pretty extraordinary, because I thought Jacinda was intense with that stuff, but Susan is really intense. And there's just an image of the three of us out there in the woods with iPads and crime scene photographs from November 17th, 1990, trying to see if trees match. And
all trees look alike.
Yeah, all trees look alike. And then I distinctly remember Susan going, I need to find this tree so I can see if there's a bullet still inside of it. And it was almost like some kind of silent comedy from, like, the 20s for a while, with us just sort of wandering around looking for stuff.
Susan, of course, not taking into account that trees grow outward, hence the ring. So you probably would not be able to find the bullet after 30 years.
Well, it was a dead log, which the log probably rotted away. Oh, okay. But if it was still there, I was like, well, someone needs to check that.
All right. What were you saying, Kevin?
I never knew, because I wasn't there when Jacinda filmed with them, with the cold case detective and the original detective. And I just assumed that we would be able to find it naively. And then you get out there and you're like, how in the hell can we actually be sure that this is the place? Like, how are we going to find it? And when Wersima was there, I mean, it was dark when he got out there. I mean, it's just, it's a very challenging thing to be certain of.
I want to let you know, after I produced this episode, Susan, I actually later that day went for a hike in the woods sort of near my house. And I ended up getting a little bit lost, and I was like bushwhacking a little bit. And I passed a game camera set up in the woods.
So you're on camera somewhere.
I leaned over. Yeah, I leaned over and I waved into it because I was just thinking, like, this could be evidence later that Susan could use to figure out exactly where I was.
Well, it actually was it used in the 2018 killing of a hunter in a different public game area in Michigan. There were game cameras set up, and they used those images to track down possible witnesses who were, like, close to the murder time, and yet they still didn't solve the case.
Right.
In this case, we got lucky because there was a crime scene tech who was at the scene that night, and his job is to, you know, correctly write down stuff and, like, you know, make a sketch that's usable later on. And he's there. He's like, okay, what the heck am I going to do to make a sketch where this podcast for 30 years from now can possibly find the site? And he's right. There's this one giant boulder in the middle of the game area. There's not many like that. So it's kind of a lucky coincidence, just one at all. And he wrote down, like, the angle from that boulder, a number of feet stretched out to a couple of fixed points. And using that, you can replicate, using a map, where the spot is, which actually really closely matched where Ron Elwell, the neighbor, went to when we were with him back there.
Right, right. So there was also issues around the location of the gun, right?
Less so, because the gun was next to a very, like, the tree is very, has a certain slant to it. So it's pretty identifiable, and it's still there and actually looks basically the same.
Jacinda, what do you think about the confusion over the location of the shootings? How has it affected this case, you think?
Well, I think when people, when you think it's closer to Titus's property line, it somehow makes him look more guilty. Like, maybe there was a dispute over hunters being on his property. But, you know, assuming the place we found is the actual crime scene, it's not close to his property line. And there would not be any dispute that they were on his property. He would know that, and they would know it, because it was back then, at least, I think it was even more well marked than it is now. The signs he put up and the wire fence, there's still remnants of all of that there. So I don't think
faded,
a little bit faded back then. I don't think there's any way anyone could have thought they were on his property, or he would have thought they were on his property.
I can't imagine that somebody who is as self-centered and rational and nervous and pessimistic and rigid as he is wouldn't know where his property lines were, right?
Yeah, he knew his property lines were. I think that there also is kind of an acknowledgement by the cold case team that these things weren't really in a spot of confusion, because although trial they kind of use this as the argument, and they have the Burnworth family say that, oh, Titus was confused about property lines to sort of promote it. The cold case team that knew that no one's going to confuse where it happened with the property, even if it's, like, closer, like where Workman goes to. So they have that theory about how, like, supposedly Doug Estes shot a deer in Titus's field and Titus, like, marched him out to the spot. And, like, one, there's zero evidence this happened because there's no deer. And two, no one heard a deer get shot. And two, like, it's hard to see. Like, that's a pretty good distance to march someone at gunpoint, and kind of a weird, it's not like an intuitively understandable theory.
Right. No, it isn't, because wouldn't you be safer if you shot somebody on your property where someone is unlikely to see you shooting somebody? I don't know. That's just my opinion. Not that I've ever planned a shooting. I'd probably be more likely to do it in a place where someone wasn't likely to wander. I want to talk about this VCR, this clock on the VCR. So Kimber, remind me who Kimber is and remind me of the importance of this clock, and then we'll talk about what happened here, Susan.
Kimber is Bennett's girlfriend. She lived with him in his little trailer on the Bennett family property north of Leonidas. And she usually worked nights. She was working days that day, got called in that morning. So she got home, she says, around 4 o'clock. And talked to Bennett. I mean, they had plans to go to dinner that evening. And when Bennett walks out the door to go hunting, he's like, I'm not going to be gone very long. He'll be back very shortly because it's already almost sunset at that point. And she says right away in her early statements, she looked at the VCR, which is basically their clock, and she saw the time 4:38 on it as Bennett left.
So, but then the cops tried to convince her that daylight saving time, like, had kept her from changing the clock, falling back of the clock, right? So it was really 3:38. Is that what they were saying?
Yeah, because Workman had a theory that it required, like, an earlier murder time. And all the timelines are so messed up, it's hard to even say that it's a better timeline because they all have problems and issues that, like, changing the time fixes some issues and causes new ones. So, but for Workima, he had the 4:30, and it's like that was what he was going for, which Kimber's story would make impossible. So he talks to her and gets her to say, oh, yeah, I forgot to change my clock back 2 weeks ago or 2 weeks after the time change. And that's why the time was wrong. But Jacinda and I went to talk to her. And I mean, Jacinda, even now, she seems pretty confident, right?
Yeah, she's pretty confident that she had, you know, that the time and the clock was correct.
Do you know if they used to videotape things using that VCR?
No.
Or do they just watch things using it? Because if you, back then, if you used your VCR to actually tape things that were on TV, the time had to be right. Otherwise, it wouldn't start the tape at the right time. So, like, it's the easiest clock to know to change because you want to, like, I'm just curious. That would be a question that I would ask.
If I talk to her again, I'll ask that.
Her argument, too, is that it was their clock. Like, they used it as their sort of, you know, general base station clock in the house. So they would have changed it. I think what she was saying was this wasn't like a random clock. Like, I hadn't set the clock on the oven. I hadn't changed that, or I hadn't changed, you know, the clock somewhere else. Like, this was our clock in the house, and everybody generally changes their bedroom clock and or their standard clock in the house. Those are things that you manage to do, even if the microwave has the time wrong for 3 months.
Hmm. And I will say, back at this time frame, I'm guessing their VCR maybe wasn't like state of the art, but in the 80s, because I remember like the clocks, the digital clocks on those VCRs were sometimes very big for that reason, so that you could know when to start it and stop it if you planned to tape a show. I mean, that was like the whole purpose. So even using it as the family clock makes sense to me. It's not like your receiver that you have under your TV now where the clock is like half an inch wide. It's like it was definitely bigger than that. I don't know what model she had. I'm not saying for sure, but I remember my VCR clock being like pretty huge. But there's also a phone call that contradicts this idea of it being 3:38, right? Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, this came later on with later records we got after Justin and I did the drive test and like debated it for a while. But
before you continue with that, the drive test. So Bennett drove what was a Camaro, right?
Yeah.
So Susan has this great idea of let's see how fast we can get from Bennett's house to the Fulton State game area and pretend like we're driving a Camaro. I thought I was going to die.
We didn't go that fast. We went like 60.
With deer crossing the road.
There were no deer. It was still daylight.
There could have been. So talk about this phone call that contradicts this idea of a 3:38 instead of 4:38 time.
Yeah, so I had no idea they ever requested Bennett's phone records until we finally got documents and said, oh, they did. And these records, unfortunately, do not cover as much as you'd want. They show calls that for not local calls, so no calls from within Leonidas, but they show outgoing longer distance calls, so calls to like other counties or other towns. And they show, and we knew from Kimber's sister that she had called that day. Bennett was asleep, and he called her back later, and they talked again for a few minutes. So we know that that was Bennett on the phone for this call to the sister. And the records show that was at 3:45 p.m. So it definitely cannot be the case that he left home at 3:38, because at 3:45, he's there and calling Kimber's sister about their dinner plans.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so there's a lot to point to that. So do you think this 3:38 thing was just like somebody had this aha moment in the squad room? They're like, let's go with this.
Yep.
Is that what happened here,
That's my guess.
Yeah. It's like, how close is it to daylight saving time? Can we use that as an excuse? Wow.
Well, and it does make it really tight for him to get there, park the car,
That's what I
want to
know. Like, why does this matter so much? Why does it matter so much?
I don't know. I mean, it's possible. We did it. We drove the distance and, you know, we know it's possible. But what it means is that he got there and was shot almost immediately.
Yeah.
So does that mean someone was waiting for him, like sitting there waiting for him just, you know, to shoot him as soon as he got there? Or did he stumble upon something already in play between Estes and the shooter? You know, I don't know for sure why they cared so much. Except it does give a little more leeway with the time frame if he gets there earlier.
And this way it does raise a question. Like, he's not there hunting if something happens to him later on. He walks into the woods and is shot and killed after getting a phone call telling him to go there.
Hmm. What do you think about this, Kevin? Because I mean, the phone call thing is a big mystery, right? We're going to talk about that next. But, like, I don't think that Bennett himself was a victim of circumstance, right? I mean, he was, it sounds like Lord here, right?
Yeah, it certainly sounds like he was Lord there for a specific reason, right? And the timeline of him getting there and being shot right away suggests that it's much less likely that he had an encounter with Titus or with anyone else hunting. Certainly makes it unlikely that he had tracked a deer onto Titus's property and then was marched off and then killed, because the timing doesn't seem to work. And so then you have to ask, well, why was he lured there? Was there some specific reason that he could have been? And it seems to me, particularly after listening to the last podcast, that someone placed the call, asked him to come, he went there, and he was gunned down. That's what it feels like when you look at the facts and when you look at the timing of it. It seems virtually very difficult for him to have been gunned down by pure chance or by a disagreement over hunting with the timeline that's presented.
Yeah, this is what I think, too. And Susan, so who made that phone call is still a mystery, right?
Yeah, we don't know for sure. And again, the fact
Why?
They never
How
came.
How come we don't know that?
Because they never came forward. And the fact they didn't, to me, is a big indication that it is something important. We know that Bennett received a couple phone calls that day, and those people, you know, did come forward. But this call that Mandy heard and that Bennett seems to reference to his girlfriend, no one's ever said they did that. And we know Bennett like did not like hunting the game area. He thought there's too many crazies there and wouldn't hunt there. So something changed his mind. And based on his comment that he's going to where the deer are, it seems like someone told him, hey, the deer are running through Fulton, which actually isn't true either, because that afternoon, no one saw any deer.
Right. Right. What do you think about this mystery phone call, Jacinda?
I think I wish we could find out who made that call, because I think it would answer a lot of our questions. You know, the other thing is that, you know, it's 4:38. He gets and he heads out. So there's not much time for hunting. Like, he's not going really to hunt, because by the time he gets there and finds wherever he's going to sit down, and the sun will be setting.
Well, Bennett didn't tend to sit so much. He did tend to like stalk around, which again, not a great idea at the game area anyway, but I guess that does make it more plausible to me that he would have been actually hunting, but it's super tight for that timeline to be true.
It was either Kimber or Mandy told us like they had actual dinner plans. Like they were going to go out that night. So for him just to pick up and leave like that, someone asked to meet him there. They had to.
The thing that stood out to me as well is that if it had been just a benign phone call, if someone had actually said, oh, come out and hunt or do whatever, if there had not been something else behind it, I mean, it's clear that it had to be somebody that he knows, right? It had to be someone who, a friend of his or an acquaintance or someone who's going to ask him to come out there, if it be hunting or what. And if it had been someone he knows, they would have known all about this. They would have known about the murder. They would have known about the fact that the police were looking for who called him. And they would have come forward and said, yeah, I called him and I told him to come out. I mean, it seems to weigh it more in the column of somebody did lure him there for a specific reason.
Yeah. No, I think so too. And did he bring a gun with him?
He had his muzzle loader.
Interesting. So let's talk about Skeeter, okay? Because Skeeter, what? He told the cold case team something about this phone call, right?
So Skeeter's comments, he gave obviously almost no statements to the original investigators. He talked to the cold case team and talked to Howard Swabash, the defense investigator. What he told the cold case team was that he remembered that he or someone else called the Bennett trailer and was told that Bennett had already left for the day to go hunting. Because he says that they're waiting for him to come back, and he didn't show, so they call the trailer to see where he is, and Kimber's girlfriend or someone says, oh, he's already left to go hunting. Which, one, seems to imply they weren't hunting at the airfield anymore, because they would have just walked to the trailer and like, hey, Jim, you there? Let's go.
Right.
And two, suggests that Skeeter remembers something about someone calling Bennett that day. And then not long after, it was probably a year or two later at that point, when Swabash, the defense investigator, talks to him, Skeeter tells him that they were all hunting that morning, and Bennett's girlfriend came out and said, hey, Bennett, you got a phone call. So Bennett went in and never came back out. This can't be true, because Bennett's girlfriend was at work that day. She was at the hospital. So that story is not true.
So I have a theory. Okay, so we heard somebody say, we'll talk about it in a second, that Skeeter may have done it. I don't know if he did or not. But I would imagine if you were Skeeter and you thought maybe you having made the phone call was problematic, you might guess that there's evidence that you made the phone call already somehow, maybe caller ID, maybe something like that. And so you've concocted something for that. I mean, because to me, that sort of seems like, you know, the he or someone else, like he knows. I mean, that was the day he died. He knows whether it was him or somebody else, right?
He should. Well, it's 10 years later at that point, they talk to the cold case team. What I still cannot explain is why no one got a statement from Skeeter back then. Why no one tried to get a statement. Lots of people were like saying, hey, go talk to Skeeter. And the only time I talked to Skeeter is about the deer story. And he's like, nope, didn't happen. And they never talked to him again. It's bizarre.
What do you think about all this, Jacinda?
You could also read it. Like, at the top of the podcast, you know, talk about, like, a lot of people were telling half-truths or, you know, no one's being 100% honest because people are dealing, you know, they're smoking weed or they don't have a legal deer tag or whatever. It could be innocent. It could be Skeeter did call and he was afraid the cops would accuse him of murder. Because he didn't want to get into trouble. He was already wanted for something else, or he had already gotten into trouble. Like, you don't know what the motive is, why someone hasn't come forward. But I do think the inconsistencies in the stories is a huge red flag.
What do you think, Kevin?
They're big.
Yeah, I agree with Jacinda. And the thing that stood out to me, the top of the podcast and just in general, when Susan and Jacinda were out in Michigan in September, and so I was looking at the case, is so many of the people involved that police need to speak to seem to have either distrust for law enforcement or potentially are involved in some kind of criminal activity, or they have something that they don't want the police to know about. And that impacts people's answers. And I think what's hard to understand is, does it impact people's answers because they're somehow involved in this particular case, or do they simply not want the police to know what they were up to at that particular time because they were doing something that they shouldn't have been doing, either illegally hunting or involved in some kind of other activity? And that's where it becomes so hard to figure out. Like, why is it that people are not telling the truth? Why is it that people are lying? And that's where I get hung up. You're just trying to figure out, well, what's their motive to do this? And that's problematic for figuring out exactly what happened.
And the other thing is, you know, everyone we talked to, I would say, that Susan and I talked to out there, everyone felt like a suspect. They were all treated like suspects. And when you feel like you're a suspect for something, I would think you stop talking. You get nervous. You're afraid that anything you say might be, you know, twisted and used against you somehow. Even Mandy felt like a suspect. Yeah. You know, Mandy was what? 13
Mandy's mother told her she was a suspect.
Yeah. So every single person that the detectives talked to, they made them feel like suspects. And I think that's a problem too.
I think
they all had a bunch of weed in their houses, right?
Yes.
They all had tons of weed, and so they were just not wanting to have contact with the police, right?
Yep. And I think that the approach, for whatever reason, the way the investigators, both Cold Case and the original guys, approached this case, every single witness ended up thinking they were a suspect, and they just shut down.
Yeah. So remind me who Mandy is, because she's the one who says that Skeeter did it, right?
She's the 11-year-old daughter of Kimber.
That's right. Okay. She says she was a kid.
She was a little kid, and she was home that day. And we do know that she was there and that Bennett was napping, because others, like the aunt, remember her answering the phone. Like, oh, Bennett's still asleep. I'll have him call you back or whatever. And we don't know what she would have said in 1990, because there's no one ever talked to her. Well, she remembers detective talking to her, but there's no record of her being talked to.
Right.
First time she's talked to and there's a record made is 2000. And that's when she tells the cold case team, oh, yeah, I got a call. It was from Skeeter.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so do we know where Skeeter and Brent went that afternoon?
Absolutely not. The part that kills me is that we don't even know where Jim Bennett was supposed to meet them. Like, the most basic facts in this case are just never got established, and there's no way now to repair some of that lost data. Because we don't know. So we do seem to know that Bennett was supposed to meet them somewhere to go hunting. Skeeter says that. Bennett's family recalls them making plans when they ran to one another in the morning. But we don't know where that was. So, like, yeah. So Bennett was supposed to show up and didn't. But where was he supposed to show up?
Hmm. I'm just curious, Kevin, are you still thinking like I am about, like, what about Estes then? Did he just, like, stumble into this, if this is a theory of the crime? And or was he lured there as well? I mean, I find myself asking that question. What about you, Kevin?
Yeah, I think at the beginning when I started looking at the case of Jacinda, I really firmly thought that it could just be a coincidence. Everybody was there. It was opening, you know, weekend of hunting season, and it seemed possible that it was a coincidence. I don't feel like it's all a coincidence now. I feel like everybody was brought there for a particular reason. I don't know who brought them there. I don't exactly know what the reason is. And some of it just comes down to my gut feeling, right? I've looked at a lot of the evidence, but it's also a gut feeling. I don't think that it was all just chance that they were all there together at the same time and that this happened. That doesn't seem to pass the bullshit test for me. And right. So I feel that there was a deliberate attempt to kill both of them. And I'm not sure who that would be. I can't say with certainty, but I don't think that they all ended up there by chance.
I think it was Mandy. No, I'm not kidding. She was a child.
Poor Mandy. She was like, "Was it like? Unless I got my little bike and like rode up there to the game area, how could it have been me?" Like, obviously, it was
right.
not her.
Right. So, do we know? So, there's this story that Jim was supposed to meet with Skeeter and Brent to go hunting. Do we know that for sure? That he had a plan to meet them.
So Brent never says that. Skeeter does say that, and the family that was hunting with him heard them talking and making plans. So it does seem to be very likely that at least Bennett is supposed to go meet with Skeeter. It is strange to me that Brent has never, ever said this. And what we have from him, Brent does not acknowledge they're supposed to meet up. Even though Skeeter is like adamant, oh yeah, Bennett was supposed to meet up with us and he just didn't show.
So wait, where did other people hear him talk to him? Was he like, did he have one of those giant brick cell phones or was it like somebody's
no,
house?
No, that morning. So Jim Bennett went out with his family on their land. So it was him and his dad and brother and they were hunting and they bumped into the Skeeter's hunting party and they all just chatted for a bit. And that's when they heard Skeeter and Brent invite Jim to go hunting with them in the afternoon.
Huh. Okay. So we don't know where they were allegedly supposed to meet or where Brent and Skeeter actually went.
No, no one's ever been able to get the same story twice. Like everyone's okay. All over the place on that.
It's also a very good story, right? We were supposed to meet up later, but he never showed up.
Right. Because then you're the person who sort of like is missing them first, which means you couldn't have done it, right? Because whoever smelled it did not dealt it. I mean, that's what I'm sorry, it's a gross analogy, but that's what I keep thinking about.
I'd never thought of it that way, Rebecca. Yeah. Right.
So there was also some confusion. We heard Kevin say earlier that this was the first weekend of deer hunting season, but some witnesses seemed to be confused about what day they were actually hunting with some of these people who were involved, right?
There's a lot of confusion over that. And it's still unclear to me who was hunting on what day and when. I mean, all the witnesses have some degree of confusion. What I do find confusing is how, like, 10 days after the murder, Brent Birch was already like, it's all fuzzy, can't remember what happened that day. I'm like, okay, 30 years on, that's allowed. That is not allowed 10 days after your friend gets killed. So we just don't have, it's really hard to reconstruct. And this many years on, there's not, I mean, if I had a magic wand, I'd want to pull up, like, the tags of the deer that was tagged by Skeeter and Chris right. Standish that day. And theoretically, I guess they could still exist, but they're not public records in Michigan, so I can't get them. But that's like at least right. one data point out there that theoretically could give us an answer to that.
I feel like you could figure out a way to get them. If anyone could, it would be you.
Break in and steal it.
I don't remember who it was, but someone mentioned the football game. Remember? They were
that
like,
was,
I know.
That's why Kevin, yeah. So Kevin was the other guy, the one who, when we started talking to him, he was like, yeah, I was hunting the Fulton game area that day.
Wait, the guy who says he doesn't know anybody involved in the case,
yes.
That guy?
Yeah, that guy. At least he doesn't have dementia, though.
Yeah, my takeaway was like, I was there with all these people, but who again? I don't really remember any of those people. I mean, that was sort of my takeaway from that.
So Kevin was confused on dates, too. He got them pretty mixed up. But what we do have is the first statement that makes it like ironclad clear. He was talking about Saturday. So it's possible he was lying back then because for whatever reason. But like in 1990, I feel confident that he was absolutely trying to say 100 on Saturday.
Why is that?
He talked about the Minden High School football game and the time and date match yep. that we found. So
okay, so that was definitely on Saturday.
Well, then. Definitely the day he's talking about back then. Whether he did right. hunt with him or not, we can't establish, but for certain, I feel certain that when he told the detectives where he was, he meant that Saturday.
Okay. Okay. So what about Brent? Was he at the Fulton Gay Mary? Jacinda, do you know?
I have no clue. I mean, I get so lost with all the different stories and, you know, who says what. But, you know, it feels like Brent was there that day.
Which would give me a reason to lie. Like, that kind of almost answers the question for me. If he was, that would explain why he felt something to hide.
What do you mean? Explain that.
If he's at the Fulton Gay Mary on the day that, or at least the season that Jim Bennett's killed there, he might preemptively freak out and think he's a suspect, and he tries to hide that, even if he was never even that part of the game area. That, to me, makes more sense than the current story, where he can't remember anything, and his statements are all over the place. And, you know, so there's a lot of people who, when I'm talking to today, they'll be like, oh, I heard Brent was there that day. I'm like, you and everybody else. But I cannot find anyone who will tell me they saw Brent there that day. Everyone's heard someone say Brent was there that day, but like the people who would like supposedly saw us, none of them will say that to me. So,
yeah. Yeah. I know that like in this circle, like these characters are not interchangeable. But as a listener, like hearing the way they sort of characterize this, they become like a little bit interchangeable in a way. And I wonder if, you know, if someone just said Brent was there, that becomes the evidence that someone else thinks that Brent was there, because it could have been a mistake, right? It could have been somebody else. It could have been a different day that the original source of that was thinking about. Yeah.
Or it's even all very, it could have been even a different time. You know, some people like to go out early. Some people like to go out.
So the part that I keep going back to is Kevin, and he tries to describe where they were. And he is not from that area. So he is definitely more disconnected from that area geographically and like socially. But when he first tells the story to me and Jacinda, he's like, we went out and hunted somewhere that morning, then we went and pushed a cornfield, then we went back to that place that night for like the dusk hunt. And then he later switches back, is like, nope, we didn't go out that evening, we pushed cornfields and we're done.
Right.
He seems to be saying they went somewhere twice that day, that he doesn't really know where it is, but it was somewhere nearby to Leonidas. And if he's talking about the Fulton Game area, which his statements kind of suggest a lot of the time, then they went there morning and evening.
Right, right. Wow. These people really like to hunt. They went out multiple times a day to do it.
Well, it's opening day, first few days, that's pretty common.
Yeah.
And also, the best time to hunt is going to be like dawn and dusk. So in between, you go home and nap.
That's right. Well, we have a question from a listener named Kate Bernstein, who wants to know, would a lot of hunters be wearing gloves? This would be another reason why there were no fingerprints on guns. Thoughts?
Yes, they were wearing gloves. We know Doug Essis was wearing gloves. Others were too. So the fact there were no prints to me is not significant evidence. I mean, you can't say someone didn't wipe it clean and then get it dirty again, but there's no evidence that makes that more probable based on what we have.
I think you would take your gloves off, and I don't know because I'm not a hunter, so if anyone does know, to load.
Yeah, but you're going to hold it again, and that's going to obscure it. Like the final time that Doug's has it, like for the past couple hours, he's had gloves on.
But so. I'm thinking more of like the bullets, like the gun that they found, Estes's gun, was fully loaded.
Yeah, but getting bullets, especially there's like a 0% chance you get prints in those bullets.
Yeah. I have a question for you, Kevin, because this is what made me think about hearing about this data about like fingerprints not being found on most guns that were seized that were related to crimes. I can think of, you know, you are a TV producer in this genre. I mean, I can think of many interviews I've done for books we've written about there being prints or no prints. Usually if there were no prints on the gun is sort of that kind of goes unquestioned. Like if you are doing an interview like that in the future, are you going to follow up by telling that person, well, they never find prints in any guns? I mean, this is something I didn't know. Is this something you knew about?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've certainly come across it before. I will say that a lot of the stories we do them because they're not clear cut, right? So you're dealing with evidence that has been obscured deliberately, or you're dealing with someone trying to clean them up. I don't put a lot of stock in there not being fingerprints for either the reason that it was wiped clean or, as Susan says, you know, people have gloves on. To me, it's one of those things where if they had found fingerprints, you go, great, we have a clear understanding of who was here and what they were doing. But the fact that you don't have them doesn't suggest anything to me one way or the other. I mean, it's just it means that somebody could have covered it up, or it means that somebody could have had gloves on. It just, to me, it just becomes a piece of evidence that you don't have. And I don't think that you can interpret, you can't read so much into it that there's a malicious intent behind it, because you don't know in this circumstance. If you found a gun in someone's living room and it hit, and there were no fingerprints on it and there's no reason for somebody to be wearing gloves, yeah, I might be a little more suspicious.
But even then, like, it's just not a good surface for fingerprints.
Yeah, It's not.
But I would still say that there's more of a chance that you're going to find one on a gun inside a house, or I would be more suspicious just as a viewer, as a regular person. Somebody, if you can tell me that someone's wearing gloves outside in November in Michigan, holding a wood and steel object, then I'm not going to immediately run there. But I think that we've all been trained, just as people who watch TV for most of our lives, that it's almost like, well, why are there no fingerprints?
Right.
I mean, you know, you go back to early dramas and people are like, there are no fingerprints on the gun. It's been wiped clean. Oh, maybe. Or maybe it hasn't.
Exactly.
I think prints in general are much rarer than we generally think of it. I've had a few interviews with like very experienced law enforcement officials, like retired or like 30, 40 years of service. And they'll tell me about a case and they're like, you know, there was a can sitting there. So I was like, okay, let's just check it because we got to check it. And oh my gosh, never expected that. There were prints on it. That never happens. Like the times they got prints in a case are like rare and stand out in memory because it's like, oh my God, it worked.
Right.
They're so used to never getting prints.
Right. And, you know, cops sometimes deliberately leave their prints on a car if they do a pullover so that, you know, if something happens, like the prints will be on the car. And it's because there are not a lot of prints. I mean, I just talked to a cop about this a few weeks ago about a case we're looking at. And it's because it's like there aren't a lot of prints on a car. You'd think there would be. They're only like in one place. But if you think about the way you open your door handle, like you may not even leave a print there. It's really something.
The one thing I take away about prints from this case, and you'll have to correct me if I'm remembering this wrong, but there are prints on some of the objects like wallet and license or whatever taken out of the victim's pockets, but they've never been able to identify who those prints belong to, but we know they don't belong to Jeff.
Right.
Right.
Or so Jim Bennett.
So those prints are more interesting to me. Like, well, we know we have a print. Who does that belong to? That I find interesting. So,
yeah.
But the gun thing, I don't, there are logical explanations out of that. So
is there any way, Susan, to get those prints rerun somehow?
I would love to think there is. I know there's still a card in the case file that still has prints showing up in the dust because I've seen it. So theoretically, if they could, just from how it looks sitting in the file, I could still see prints clearly on it.
Right.
So if nothing else, even if they don't have photocopies, I know where that card is.
Jacinda, I've been thinking a lot about you because, you know, Susan's continuing to work this case and, you know, you've spent a lot of time in it. Are your feelings about what could have happened here evolving as Susan turns up more and more stuff?
Yes and no. You know, I started out not knowing or not feeling certain what Tyus's role was in all of this, right? Now I feel very strongly that he did not do it.
Hmm.
You know, whether it's Thomas Dillon or whether it's someone who is after Bennett or whether, you know, always a few minutes ago we talked about this. There's always been this little question in the back of my mind of, was somebody introducing Jim and Doug that day? Was this like an introduction to bring the two drug worlds together? So in terms of what actually happened that day, I'm not sure where I stand at the moment.
So Jacinda, the thing is, for me, my answer to that question, that's all I've got really, is that if that was happening, why not use Gary Kremble? He's the cousin of Estes, who also knows his friends of Bennett. Like there were connections. So like the Woodland, I mean, again, what if...
But we don't know. Yeah. He could have been the guy who called.
Right, right.
Right? Yeah. Like we don't know.
Susan, next week is the finale of this series. What shall we expect to hear on this final episode on the Tyus case?
More about why this crime scene and case was more confusing than is fair.
Well, all right. I mean, that's how I felt this whole season. I felt disoriented. I felt confused about what could have possibly happened here. And I'm really curious to hear what your conclusions are at the end of it. Susan Simpson, thanks so much for talking to me on this week's addendum. And I look forward to hearing next week's episode.
Thanks, Rebecca.
And Jacinda and Kevin, thank you so much for joining us again. It's always a pleasure talking to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's addendum. Do you have questions for next time? Tips about any of the cases covered on the podcast? You can email your questions and tips to undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com or send them to us on social media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The handle is always at @undisclosedpod. Audio production for the addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. The executive producer of Undisclosed is Methil Telhan. I'm Rebecca Lavoy. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime review podcast, Crime Writers On, or listen to You Can't Make This Up, the Netflix podcast on which I interview directors of true crime documentaries. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening to this series and for sticking with these cases. It's so great how much you care about them. We'll talk to you soon.